This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. We are, for this next half hour, going to get into one of our conversations with great minds. I'm so glad to have with us Dr. Douglas Rushkoff. He's the founder of the Laboratory for Digital Humanism and a professor of media theory and digital economics at City University, New York, Queen's Research Fellow, Institute for the Future, author of more than 20 books, including his latest just released, Team Human: Our Technologies, Markets, and Cultural Institutions, Once Forces for Human Connection and Expression, Now Isolate and Repress Us. It's time to remake society together, not as individual players, but as the team we actually are. Last time we talked with Douglas was about your book, Present Shock, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was last time. Yeah,
and some time ago.
Yeah, and that was 2013.
2013.
I did
yeah.
one between then and now called Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus,
which sounds like a great book.
Yeah, all the sort of the inequality of the digital economy, and now Team Human.
So before we get to Team Human, let's just talk. Oh, and by the way, you're here in Portland. You're live in the studio with me because tonight you're going to be doing a gig at Powell's Books, which is just legendary and a wonderful venue.
Best
you're going to love
ever.
It. It really is. And then tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night I'm doing a Team Human Live. It's a podcast I do, but I do them sometimes in live audiences at Bunk Bar here in Portland, too.
Here in Portland, too. Okay, great, because you know we're also on the air here in Portland on X-Ray FM. So to start with throwing rocks at the bus, at the Google bus, people were actually throwing rocks at you. These were the Google, I'm sorry, I missed that book of yours. These were the buses that Google uses in Silicon Valley to transport their workers around?
Yeah, I mean, the whole book wasn't about that, but it kind of served as a starting point that, you know, here's a company that was two kids from Stanford. We're going to take down big, bad corporate Yahoo by creating a people's algorithm that would let us search the net in a new way from the bottom up. And, you know, they took too much money and ended up being this really awful extractive behemoth that needs to grow. And people who lived in San Francisco, where the company's operating, you know, watch their real estate prices and their rents go way, way up, you know, to the point where the city's unlivable for them. And the employees who live there, and it was sort of a nice idea that Google thought, instead of having them drive back and forth, we'll create these big air-conditioned Wi-Fi buses that'll transport them back, you know, to and from the mothership.
Right.
But to people in San Francisco, it felt like sort of a symbol of the alien invasion. Here are these people that are using San Francisco as a backdrop and a bedroom community, making it unlivable for real people, while all the capital, all the resources are being sucked out by this big company down in Mountain View. And, you know, it wasn't just that the prices, real estate prices or rents tripled and quadrupled, but if you were in walking distance of one of the Google bus stops, your rent was another 30% higher than it was elsewhere. So people started laying down in front of the buses and saying, you know, gentrification. And then in Oakland, someone actually threw a rock at one of the Google buses, and the sort of, you know, very minor riot happened, and people were tweeting at me saying, "Oh, Doug, aren't you going to cheer on what happened?" Like, I can't cheer that on because
it's violence.
And I got friends on that bus, you know, who are just trying to make a living and earn however much they need to earn before they burn out. You know, so I wanted to sort of unwind that and show how we're all responsible for this sort of extractive explosion.
Well, and we see this, I mean, not just in San Francisco with Google. We see this not necessarily with the bus, but this dynamic at work with Amazon in Seattle. With Starbucks in Seattle, perhaps.
With Uber in London, maybe. It depends. It's everywhere. Yeah. And it's because of that big disconnection. These companies are not serving real people or places. What they're doing is serving shareholders. These are all extractive models.
It seems like there's an analogy or an analog between that and, for example, how Walmart moves into a community and destroys on average 100 local businesses, and they will target those businesses. And
absolutely, you know. And I wrote about that. But what it takes Walmart, say, 10 or 15 years to do in a community, where they go in, they undercut all the local sellers, put everyone out of business, so they become not only the sole retailer but the sole employer in a community, so then they can underpay people or have them on part-time wages. Then all those people who are working at Walmart are also on food stamps and on welfare, and, you know, in order, and on Medicaid or whatever, to get basic services. So the net effect is a drag. But Walmart's playbook is based on the British East India Company's playbook, the early colonial playbook of extractive capitalism.
Which we rebelled against with the Boston Tea Party.
Right. And folks like Adam Smith, who are become the patron saints of libertarianism, were actually the people arguing about the problem of large capitalism.
Oh, the theory of moral sentiments.
Right.
I mean, he wrote an entire book that was basically, here's the dangers of capitalism. Uh-huh. And the phrase invisible hand only appears once in Wealth of Nations, and
right.
it appears that in that one place, in the context of protective tariffs, essentially. I mean, the sentence begins something like preferring domestic manufacture to that of foreign, you know, blah, 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 the
exactly.
invisible hand, blah, blah.
You know, which is really my pivot to this book, to Team Human, was where I was realizing, well, these sort of large abstracted rule sets, you know, that used to be enforced by law in British East India time or Walmart time are now being enforced with code. You know, so we're sort of reifying.
By code, you mean digital
computer
code?
Computer code. That now we're living on digital landscapes that are just as oppressive as, you know, the stock market or industrialism or the economic operating system that we were using. You know, that Mark Zuckerberg and people who are building digital companies are really building them on top of an operating system that they're not even acknowledging. They didn't go to school. They drop out of college at 19 before they've taken economics, before they've taken anthropology. So they don't know that there's another operating system embedded in the platforms they're building.
And that operating system is?
Corporate capitalism. It's extractive corporate capitalism.
Right.
How do we use human beings as a profit center for shares?
This is digital colonialism.
It's exactly digital colonialism. And it's why, and it's interesting, it's why even privileged white males now can experience what it's like to be an indigenous population, because at least we're indigenous to the real world. And now we're seeing this sort of algorithmic invasion.
Which is why you're seeing privileged white males voting for Donald Trump when he promises them that he's going to at least give them back the dignity that they had in the 50s, 60s, 70s when they could get a union job without bringing back the unions.
Right, right. And what he is speaking to, and this is sort of what I'm trying to speak to also, and that we all have to speak to, is that it sounds so new agey, but there's an essential dignity to human beings,
yes.
that we are worth more than our utility value. You know, and that, again, it goes back to Marx, and I'm sorry, but, you know, human beings.
Marx's analysis was
spot
solid.
On.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, it's that we are more than the inputs and outputs. And the minute that we take on the market's logic as our own, the minute that we only value ourselves in terms of our utility and what we can produce, that's when we've lost.
Yeah. So back in the 1960s, a guy named Robert Bork came up with an idea. Back in the 1880s, 1881, 82, whatever it was, Senator Sherman from Ohio first introduced what came to be the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. And it was vigorously enforced by Teddy Roosevelt and by Taft, you know, after him. And the whole idea of this was that bigness, giant corporations getting too large, controlling markets either vertically or horizontally, was a bad thing because it was destructive to communities, which is what you've just been talking about. It was destructive to what they would refer to as competition, what today we would call entrepreneurism or entrepreneurialism, the ability of small people to start companies to compete with them. It was destructive of families. It was not honoring, in many cases, not even honoring the institutions of the company that they were producing, you know, vast, vast differences in wealth, inequality in wealth, that these were all the evils of monopoly. And that was widely understood in the United States. In the 60s, Bork came along, wrote a paper about this, and said, no, that's all wrong. What Senator Sherman really was talking about, and what we really need to worry about when we enforce antitrust law, is the prices consumers pay. And the only metric that we should use to decide whether we're going to break a company up or forbid a merger is whether or not it's going to lower prices for consumers. And that became a doctrine that was adopted by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case, I'm forgetting the name, Sullivan is in that name, in the 1970s, I think it was 77, and it became the policy of the Reagan administration. And we have had no antitrust enforcement since then that doesn't specifically deal with nothing but is the consumer still getting a cheap price. So they don't view Walmart as a monopoly, for example,
right.
even if it may be the only store within 1,000 or within 100 miles
right.
for a town, because you still have cheap Chinese junk that you can buy
right.
at low prices.
And the only metric they're looking at is the price, but not the cost.
That's right.
Yeah.
So how do we A, if we've accurately diagnosed at least one small piece of the problem, how do we wake Americans up to that, and how do we change that?
Well, a bunch of ways. I mean, the simplest team human approach would be, how do we help people see themselves as sort of 360-degree human beings rather than just in their roles as consumers? You know, yeah, I'm a consumer sometimes, but I'm a parent, I'm a producer, I'm a worker, I'm all these other things. So if I'm understanding my rights in terms of that customer's always right, and that's the way I express myself, well, then look, then we get an American Idol presidential election,
right.
Of course,
which is what we have,
right? Because we've bought into that. We've bought into that sensibility. I mean, one cure for that is going to be when people don't have the money to buy stuff anymore. So they're going to have to start looking
around.
Well,
that's what happened in the late 20s, early 30s. You know, and by the way, that's also what happened in 1846 with the Great Depression then that led to the Civil War. It's what happened in 1770 and the Great Panic of 1770 that led to the Tea Party, that led to the American Revolution. I mean, it seems that about every 80 years and the fourth turning, those guys, I'm forgetting their names right now, Howe and Strauss,
yeah,
wrote about this, about how every 80 years we have this, a collapse followed by a war,
right,
followed by a reboot, and typically a major progressive reboot,
right,
which I've been kind of hoping for.
Yeah, but that reboot's only going to work if people engage with one another rather than their devices. In other words, as things get worse, are we going to retreat into video games and Twitter and bad TV? You know, are we going to have enough money to do that? Or are we going to decide that other people are more interesting?
Well, isn't this what Robert Draper was writing about in 2001 or 3 or whenever he wrote Bowling Alone?
Right.
If I'm remembering his name.
Yeah, Robert Putnam.
Putnam,
yeah.
That's right.
And he was looking at the collapse of civic society's institutions.
Yeah.
You know, everything from the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts to the Elks Club
and
the Kiwanis.
And asking why. And some of the possible answers were cable TV. People are working too hard. Reaganism has destroyed the middle class. And now we've got, everybody's addicted to their screens. Is there another piece to this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of it. It's really, we are taking a potentially very powerful connecting industry, the internet. I mean,
right,
you were around for the beginning when it was going to...
Oh, I ran forums on CompuServe,
yeah,
in the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. And it was, and we all, a lot of us believed that it was going to be the realization of the kind of the Gaian mind. This is the way the humans and the planet would connect up each other's nervous systems and get to experience...
Oh, and we had extraordinary community in our CompuServe communities, but
yeah,
you were required to use your real name, which is a
yeah,
whole other thing. We'll get,
and there was a rule you weren't allowed to do commercial activity online either.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Dr. Douglas Rushkoff is with us. Team Human is his new book. We'll be right back. It's our Conversations with Great Minds.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
His website, Rushkoff, RUSHKOFF.com. You can tweet him at Rushkoff. And welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Douglas Rushkoff, his book, Team Human, Our Technologies, Markets, and Cultural Institutions and Now Isolate and Repress Us. How unique is this in human history? I mean, I called him Draper. You said his name was
Putnam.
Putnam, that's right. My recollection, and I literally, it's been 20 years since I read, or 17 years since I read his book or whatever, was that he was mostly pointing a finger at, number one, people were working longer and harder because of the destruction of unions, and number two, television, cable television, if I'm remembering correctly. Is there, now you're talking about, the digital
yeah,
forces that are tearing us apart. Are there, is this something that's cyclical?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, it's older. I think that there's some really old and disparaging notions about human beings and our behavior that we're kind of embedding in our digital infrastructure, and they're not really true. So the idea that evolution was a competition between individuals for the survival of the fittest. Read Darwin.
That's what Herbert Spencer said.
Right. Exactly. It's what Spencer said, or Hayek or
yeah,
someone else. It's not. Evolution is actually the story of how species collaborate and cooperate with one another in order to ensure mutual survival.
To assure homeostasis, basically.
Right.
Environmental stasis.
Right. I was taught in school that the big tree, is getting all the sun and shades the little one, and the little one will perish and the big one will live. Turns out that's not true. The big tree is sharing nutrients with the little tree through a network of mycelia in the soil,
right.
which turns out to be alive and not just dirt.
Yep.
And then, you know, in the winter, when the big tree loses its leaves, the little one's an evergreen. It returns through the soil matrix some nutrients to the big tree, and the mushrooms take a service fee for it.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
So it's like, well, wait a minute. What's that? That's not the story I was told. And then we learn that, you know, if human beings really are the most advanced species, it's really just to the extent that we can collaborate and communicate. So we develop language and text and all these things to allow for higher levels of coordination. But, you know, really when we take any of these tools, even when we use text, you look at the first use of text, and it was to count slaves. To keep track of people's slaves.
Back 7,000 years ago in Sumeria.
Yeah, when they were, that's what they used it for. You know, you look at the printing press. You know, no, people were not allowed to do their own little pamphlets on the thing. You know, the government controlled the printing press and they'd kill you.
In fact, it was against the law to be literate if you weren't a Catholic priest.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
For quite some time.
So they control, you know, so we look at these potentially liberating technologies and we say, oh, well, look, you know, the elites end up controlling them. So now we have the internet and people really have gained the capability of the printing press era. We can write, you know, we can publish, but we can't program. We don't program the environments in which this happens. So you can, you know, write on Facebook till the cows come home. And all you're really doing is enabling algorithms that are looking to modify and control your behavior.
Yeah. This is you know, remarkable stuff. Do you see the internet right now as it's been reshaped, as a malicious force or as a neutral force or as a positive force?
It's primarily being used as a manipulative force, right? There's a multi-trillion dollar industry looking at how to control human behavior through our devices. Every time you swipe on your smartphone, it gets smarter about you and you get dumber about it. And if you want to get smarter about it, you're going to open it up and find all of these black box proprietary algorithms that you're not even allowed to know what they're doing.
Right.
You know, and when you learn what they're doing, you find out, oh, Facebook is taking my past behavior in order to put me in a statistical bucket
and predict my future.
And predict or modify my future.
We're hitting a break here. Yeah. We'll be right back. Welcome.
I want to say that chickpea tinga taco.
Yeah. I would eat that. For our commercial stations, I was just doing a live read for HelloFresh.com/Tom. So it's a great organization.
I like that phrase, chickpea tinga taco.
Yeah, and we're pleased to have companies that sponsor our program. It keeps us in business.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're talking with Doug.
Do a podcast. We're just begging our listeners to give us $2 a month.
Yeah. That's a model, too.
It works.
We're talking to Douglas Rushkoff. His new book is Team Human. And we were just talking during the break about how kind of these things are not altogether new. And in hyper-simplified version, you know, if you look at European history for the last millennia, right, there was this long, long period of basically feudalism. And then the Black Death came along, the bubonic plague, killed off a third of Europe. That created such a labor shortage that wages went up. A middle class emerged, essentially, as a consequence of this, the first unions in the 1300s, late 1300s. And that produced the Renaissance, right?
Yeah.
People could music, art, literature. Nobody had time for that before because everybody was essentially a slave. And then that faded out after about three generations, and the kings took over again, and then the printing press came along. And some people say that the printing press is what led us right to the Enlightenment, and right to, you know, Rousseau and John Locke and Thomas Jefferson and onward we go. These were disruptive events. I was going to say disruptive technologies, but the bubonic plague was not a technology. But these were major disruptive events that had historical consequences that literally are ringing to this day. And I'm wondering, putting it in that kind of a context, in that kind of very large context, in the development of radio in the United States, in the world in the 1920s, the development of television in the 1950s, the development then of the internet in the 1970s and 80s, what does this mean for us? How do we, as a species, deal with these kinds of disruptive cycles? And are they always, do they always end up just accruing to the benefit of the East India companies of the world?
Yeah, I mean, if we don't realize what the disruption could do, then they end up not being disruptions. They end up, you know, the digital revolution is a reactionary movement by Wall Street against the potential for wider distribution of wealth that the internet promises. Well, in the early 90s, we used to think of the internet as unleashing the new possibilities for the collective human imagination. Right. And by the time Wired magazine came out and said, no, the internet is the salvation of the NASDAQ stock exchange, that this is an investment opportunity. So we really pivoted the entire internet from connecting people to extracting value from people. We used it as an extension or an amplification of the attention economy.
Absolutely amazing. I'm sorry, we're out of time. Dr. Douglas Rushkoff is the author of the Rushkoff.com, the website. He'll be at Powell's tonight here in Portland. The new book is Team Human. Thank you so much.
Thank you for
being
you
with
do.
Us, Douglas. It's great having you in the studio. We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
And I'll be back with more of the news of the day and your calls right after this. Stick around. Welcome back. Time for our geeky science for the week. Yep. Trump has put a climate change denier in charge of his panel that's looking into whether climate change is a threat to the national security. This guy has compared scientists who study carbon pollution to Nazis who killed Jews. I'm not exaggerating. He literally has made that exact parallel. And what's really going on here is that the fossil fuel industry, just like the tobacco industry before it, the fossil fuel industry is making billions on the deaths of people. You know, except that the fossil fuels are killing the entire planet, whereas tobacco was just killing, 500,000 Americans a year, mostly by lung cancer and heart disease and premature aging and all kinds of other things that come along with tobacco use. But these guys, they're killing the planet. I mean, the tobacco industry, they went out and they bought their politicians. One of them was Mike Pence. In 2000, Mike Pence wrote an op-ed about how tobacco, the link between tobacco and cancer is not that well established. Right. And the fossil fuel industry, they're funding politicians and think tanks, which aren't like people who sit around and think. They're just hustlers who go out and do TV shows to push their lies and sustain their profits. And this guy is, by the way, he has no background in meteorology. He's a retired professor of physics. Got nothing to do with the atmosphere. And Trump is putting this climate change denier in charge of his Senate panel. And the other study that was just done showed that the Republican senators who deny climate change most aggressively are the ones who get the most money from big oil and big coal. There's an absolute relationship between how much money these industries give these senators and how aggressively these senators lie to us about climate change. It is absolutely mind-boggling. We've covered a lot of territory today. We were talking with Doug about his Team Human book and the digital situation. I don't want to call it digital divide. It's brilliant. Douglas Rushkoff is a brilliant writer, brilliant man. We had Dr. Richard Wolff on an hour ago, who was talking about the situation in Venezuela and how it is being wildly and badly misunderstood by both the American people and the American press, and how Bolivia, which is a socialist country that's every bit as socialist as Maduro or Chavez were, is actually one of the fastest growing countries in South America, that what you're looking at is the consequence of American intervention, American destruction of the Venezuelan economy through embargoes and things like that. And then in our first hour, we had a conversation with Julio, in which he was saying that, tearing kids away. Well, I don't want to characterize what he was saying, but I was saying that Donald Trump and Mike Pence should be charged with kidnapping and child abuse for what they're doing. And your calls on any of those topics. Barbara in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Barbara, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm sitting under 34 inches of snow.
Oh, that'll do it.
Oh, man, it snows. You would not believe it. It's really bad out there. Snow is everywhere.
Wow.
But I was listening to the young man this morning, the Julio Rivera, I think his name was,
Rivera,
if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And I had to stop and think in my mind, how did his forebears get here?
I'm pretty sure that Julio's grandparents live in Puerto Rico, because he goes back there to visit them.
Okay, now think about it. What has Donald Trump done for Puerto Rico? Nothing.
Right.
But he's whining and crying about children, you know, about children being taken away from their parents and coming across
yeah.
the border.
Barbara, can we step back from this? Because Julio's not here to defend himself.
I understand. No, I'm not.
I don't want to make this about him.
I know the man, and I'm not going to make him, you know, go punch him back or nothing like that. I don't do that.
What
I'm talking about is let's think about why they're taking these young men. You got to think about the young men maybe between, 13, 14, 15, and 16, I think, that are down there in those camps.
Oh, there are babies that are being taken from their parents, and they're both boys and girls.
Yeah.
And it's apparently thousands of them.
Yeah, let's think about it this way, economically. Okay, let's say they're 13, 14, and 15 years old. Let's just, you know, say that.
Okay, that's a percentage of them,
planters,
certainly.
Yeah, these are planters and pickers that are for free.
And in fact, one of the stories that we did on the show either earlier this week or late last week was about how in several of these internment camps that the Trump administration has paid private for-profit corporations to build, that in these internment camps, these children and their parents who are separated are being given opportunities to work for free or for a dollar a day to clean the toilets, to do the laundry, to mop the floors, just like in real prisons. And that it's all protected by the 13th Amendment because that authorizes slavery if you're in jail. The problem is these people haven't committed a crime. It's not a crime to come to the United States seeking asylum. In fact, it's perfectly legal.
This is the crux of the whole deal. I grew up watching basically slavery in the, let's say, the what I can remember from the 50s to the 60s. Mm-hmm. And I would go with my grandmother, you know, to clean these ladies' houses. This is what the women had to do of our generation, of our color, had to do to make a living.
Right.
And they expected you to bring a child with you to help work. Okay, these women have come across the borders. They got the little children. Okay, we can give the little children to some organization to help them do whatever they're going to do. We know what that's all about. Mm. But in the other words, we're going to use the children that are able to pick, that are able to plant, that are able to clean, that are able to harvest. This is the economic boom for the large agro farms.
Yeah. It may well be, Barbara, and this is why we need to have the disinfectant of sunlight. We need to be opening up these facilities. There were a couple of Democratic senators or members of the House, I'm not sure which, who visited one of these internment camps that the Trump administration has built in, I think it was in New York State, a couple of days ago, and they came back and said they were just horrified. You know, children in cages, horrible conditions. You know, I don't know that they were talking about forced labor, but certainly that is happening in some of these camps. Barbara, you nailed it. Thanks so much for the call. Howard in New York City. Hey, Howard, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just want to mention that if the Mueller report is really going to be tried to be published next week, can they just indict somebody like the subversion of the blocking of investigations with a Flynn and Comey? Why don't they just indict him and publish the indictment before it goes to the Attorney General?
Well, they have issued over 100 indictments to this point, you know, including, you know, for people in Russia, people here in the United States, you know, Roger Stone, Manafort, Cohen, Papadopoulos, et cetera, et cetera. So they have done a lot of that, and a lot of that has informed us about exactly what the crimes are that the Trump crime family has been committing, and that the Trump campaign was committing, and that apparently at least one and probably multiple foreign governments were committing in order to make Donald Trump president. But that's one possibility. But Howard, I thank you for calling and pointing that out. But the point that I want to go back to over and over and over again, because I don't think it could be emphasized enough because the media refuses to report on it, is you go back and look at the archives in the New York Times for Christmas Day 1992, Christmas Day 1992. It was 2 weeks before George Herbert Walker Bush had to leave office. And Lawrence Walsh, the special counsel, was breathing down his neck. He was about to issue a subpoena for George Bush's diaries that would show where he was, when he was, what he was doing. And Bush did not want to give those diaries because he knew that he could end up in a federal prison for the Iran-Contra scam, where they cut a deal with the Iranians to hold the hostages and ruin Jimmy Carter's presidency to put Ronald Reagan into office. And then they paid off the Iranians, thank you very much for that, with illegal weapon sales. And then they took the money from those illegal weapon sales and used it to buy weapons and send them down to Central America and send death squads into Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador. Elliot Abrams was in the middle of this stuff. And the guy who pardoned him, Caspar Weinberger and Elliot Abrams, the guy who recommended to George Bush that on Christmas Day of 1992, and look at the New York Times screaming headline across the front of the page, the guy who pardoned them, or who recommended that Bush pardon them, and he took the recommendation, was the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr. The same William Barr who was sworn in as Attorney General of the United States just a few days ago. And all of a sudden, Robert Mueller is wrapping up his investigation. William Barr comes in, Robert Mueller goes out. That, to me, does not seem like a coincidence when you look at how those five pardons, or maybe it was six, five or six pardons, that George Bush did on Christmas Eve of 1992, those pardons at the behest of Barr, and Barr came right out and said, Bush came to me and said he just wanted to pardon Weinberger, and I said, no, in for a pound, in for a dozen, or whatever the saying, in for a penny, in for a pound, whatever the saying was. He said, I told him to pardon everybody. It's right there in the New York Times. And by pardoning everybody, they shut down the investigation. And Lawrence Walsh, the special counsel, he held a press conference on the day before Christmas and said, this is a cover-up that William Barr is orchestrating. William Safire, the famous New York Times columnist, referred to Bill Barr as the cover-up general, not as the attorney general, in his columns. That's the guy who was put in charge of the Mueller investigation 4 or 5 days ago by Donald Trump. And now we're hearing, well, they're going to wrap the thing up. I can add two and two together and figure out what four looks like. And I think most of us could if we had the information. But for some reason, none of our media, I have heard one mention of this, and this was about 3 weeks ago on Rachel Maddow's show. Outside of that, I have heard no mention of William Barr's role in the get out of jail, in shutting down the investigation into George Bush's role in Iran-Contra on Christmas Day 1992, or the day before Christmas.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we all need to be looking at this because this tells us exactly what's going to happen. It's just history repeating itself. This is why this guy was hired by Trump. And welcome back, Tom in Stamford, Connecticut. Hey, Tom, thanks for watching us on YouTube. What's up?
Hi, I just wanted to comment on the psychopathy of Donald Trump in Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, 2 days ago on MSNBC, The Last Word, O'Donnell,
mm-hmm.
he read an excerpt out of
Andrew McCabe's book.
Yes. And in there, in early 2017, after or during a meeting he was having with his security people, he said, how come we aren't going to war with Argentina?
No, it was Venezuela.
Oil.
You're right. Trump said to McCabe, we should have a war. If you want to have a war, it should be in our backyard, Venezuela. They've got all the oil. You're right, Tom.
Yeah. And it just goes right to his psychopathy that he just has no morals, no ethics.
I think he's trying to provoke a war with Venezuela in order to be a war president when the election comes. Because when, 1 year before the election is when George W. Bush invaded Iraq. 1 year before mm-hmm. the election is when Ronald Reagan invaded Grenada. Mm-hmm. 1 year before the election is when Margaret Thatcher and, had her little war with the Falklands. As I recall, I might be off on that 1 year part. But, it dramatically increased her popularity. Mm-hmm. I think this is Trump's reelection strategy, Tom. I really do. Tom, I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you. Liz in Redmond, Washington. Hey, Liz, thanks for listening to KBCS. What's up?
Oh, hi. I didn't realize that
you are on the air.
You were coming to me next. Here I am. Yeah. Did you hear about the billboard put up in Times Square accusing or thanking, I should say,
Alexandria Ocasio?
Yeah. For the Amazon pullout.
Yeah.
Oh, you were. Oh,
yeah, Robert Mercer apparently paid for it. She actually retweeted it and said, this is what we're up against, you know, billionaires who are feeding us, shoveling us BS.
Right. And was it yesterday or day before yesterday you were talking to a woman, was it Job Creators Network that
yes.
she was with?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, they're the ones that put the billboard up.
Oh, they are? Oh,
yeah.
Oh, interesting.
It's paid for by Mercer. I saw that. I was reading that in the article. The article's in the commondreams.org.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was interesting, and I was wondering if you'd heard about it.
Yeah, I did. I saw it this morning. I saw the tweet this morning, and it was pretty. What is so cool about AOC is that she fights back. You know, I mean, it's been a long time since there was a Democrat who fought back.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, that's great.
And she is just not taking it. She absolutely is not taking it. Liz, thank you so much for the call. And yes, this actually happened. You know, Amazon is pulling out of New York because New Yorkers don't want them there. And they don't want the billions in tax breaks and whatnot to go to Amazon. They just don't, you know, they just don't want it happening. And so a billionaire puts a billboard up in Times Square that says, well, here's how many jobs you're going to lose, and it's all because of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or words to that effect, or implications to that effect. And she tweets it out and says, look at this. Isn't this amazing? Look at his pain for this. Wow. We'll be right back. It's the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Jason in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Jason, thanks for listening to us on WBAI there. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to comment on climate change, what you just mentioned. First of all, the term Holocaust denier is not a term that should be used in a thing like that. Denier is like a thing that's a fact, and you deny it, you're a denier. Climate change is just not a fact. It's a hoax from a few socialist job-hating people.
And so Jason, let me get this straight. You're trying to tell me that climate change is a hoax?
That's not my point. My point was that denier is not...
Well, whatever your point is, are you trying to tell me that climate change is a hoax?
It's not a fact. It's not a fact that if you can show me...
Where did you learn this, Jason?
What?
Where did you learn this?
I learned it that there was a few places in the United States that were the coldest in the history. And I don't see anything that could be, that get hot.
So did you hear this on the radio? Did you see this on television? Who gave you this idea that because we have extreme cold weather right now that there's not global warming or climate change?
I don't know, but the only thing, the only place
you just came up with it yourself.
It is climate change. I see on the
time. Jason, it's an absolute predictable. This is what the climate scientists were predicting, what's called a circular wind pattern in the Arctic in the winter. Basically a giant Arctic cyclone that runs for about 3 months during the winter, would start to break apart as the planet warmed, and pieces of that winter, it's called the polar vortex, pieces of that would then slide down to more southern climates, which is exactly what happened just a week or so ago as part of that polar air mass slid down over the north, central and eastern parts of the United States. It's been happening now for about 5 years. This is the result of climate change. The polar vortex at the Arctic, which, you know, prior to about 10 years ago had always maintained its integrity, broke into three pieces this year because so much of the ice is gone that stabilizes it. You got open water. It's warmed in the Arctic about 4 degrees Celsius now. We're 1 degree Celsius for the whole planet, but the Arctic is warming faster. And that's why the cold air came. Just, Jason, it is not a hoax. It's real. I hope you can do your research on this and figure out what's going on. Tony, I don't have a city for you. Where are you calling from? Thanks for listening on Sirius XM, though.
I'm listening to you. Well, I'm a truck driver. I'm on the road, but I'm out of Hesperia, California.
Okay, great. What's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm glad to hear you talking about this key of separation. How can people get away with this?
I think it's a crime. Not just a moral crime. I think it's a legal crime. I think people should be prosecuted for it.
I do, too. I came into this country with my parents. I was born in Cuba. I'm a Cuban. I'm an American now, but I was born in Cuba. I came here. I was 9 years old. And if we would have, we never went through this. We went through the same thing, asking for asylum.
Yes. Yeah.
And Tom, if you go to the border, or I go to the border, and take a kid out of a mother's arm and take up with him, we're going to get charged with kidnapping.
That's right. That's right.
Tom, I know that I call you, but this thing with murder that's coming down, this investigation, Trump is going to get away with everything. He's getting away with everything. And I can't see how the people in this country, if you're a true American, how red-blooded America can't believe you are supporting this person.
Yeah. I don't think Trump is going to get away with it, Tony. I think there's a reckoning coming that, he's been able to weasel out of everything in his life because of his wealth and his privilege. I think it's coming to an end, but we'll see. Tony, thank you for the call. Let's hope for the best. Bob in Columbia, Missouri. Hey, Bob, got the last minute here. What's up?
Yeah, there's so much that happens. That last caller is very moving. Just every American should be just outraged, and is, I believe. But OCA is a real deal, man. I wanted to talk to you about...
You mean AOC?
I'm sorry.
That's all good. It's all good. For anybody who didn't know what you're talking about, that's why...
She's got tons of ideas, and yeah, she's not varnished, but, she's got great ideas, and that's
what
we need.
That woman is going to be president someday.
I think so. Venezuela, you're right. It's the next angle that Trump and the Republicans are thinking to do exactly what you've been saying. Historically, it all lines up. The other thing is Barr. Barr was in 92. What you say about Christmas Day, I looked it up yesterday. And they don't let you look at the New York Times headline without paying for it. But there's a lot of other information that indicates exactly what occurred. And I remember it in real time, as do you. And I was outraged at what was happening, because they were kissing it off and letting it go right in the, that turbulent time around the holidays, new president's coming in, you understand.
And the Democrats were outraged in Congress anyway, it's such a shame that the Clinton administration didn't really go after that, but that was that era of, okay, we're going to move on, we're going to move forward. But it was William Barr, it was Bill Barr, who is currently our attorney general, who in 1992 was attorney general and shut down the Iran-Contra investigation by recommending that Bush issue those 6 pardons. Bob, thanks for the call. We will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.